Hi, Bill.
Hi there, Con. How you doing?
Doing well. We're here for another edition of This Week in Blog, the last one of 2008. Very exciting.
You had a good holiday?
I did. I did nothing. Stayed home with the wife and kid.
I think that's the answer to the question, what would Jesus do? It's nothing.
Well, you know, when people ask me what I want to do on my birthday, I always say nothing.
Excellent. Well, we haven't had a This Week in Blog in 2 weeks.
Well, I did one the week before
With Sarah.
Sarah, right, out in Vancouver.
We took last week off.
Right.
So much has percolated since then. Should we start off with
Israel, why not?
What's that?
Gaza.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there'll be other folks on Blogging Heads who are more foreign policy experts than you or I, so let's maybe try not to get too deep in the arguments. But I thought that Jane Hampshire, Fire Dog Lake had a particularly notable post as far as what we generally talk about is how the blogosphere is impacting national discourse, and it was about how on the left that there is much more open debate and blogging around Mideast politics when a lot of folks were somewhat self-censoring themselves over the last few years and not wanting to wade into these treacherous waters. And Jane credits that to three things. One, the rise of J Street, which is a new Jewish political action group to be a progressive counterweight to AIPAC. I think there are a lot of liberal progressive Jews that have been frustrated that AIPAC has been seen as the sole voice of the Jewish community when there is a diversity of opinion in the Jewish community, like any community. And they've definitely changed the dynamic. Two, she actually credits Joe Klein, which I know, Con, you treat Joe Klein like every other liberal, but in liberal blogosphere, Joe Klein has long been seen as an enemy. And Jane says the importance of Joe
well
Klein.
Aware.
I'm sorry?
I'm well aware.
The importance of what Joe Klein did in the face of intimidation tactics from the extreme right cannot be overstated. When Jennifer Rubin of Commentary Magazine called Klein an anti-Semite for criticizing Israel, and the ADL piled on and condemned him, it was pretty much a standard operating procedure for them. Tactics had silenced many critics before, but Klein was totally and appropriately enraged with this kind of thuggery and fought back publicly on the pages of Time. And then three, she generally says leadership. What Klein did to Commentary Magazine and the ADL, Glenn Greenwald has done to Marty Peretz and a neocon propaganda organ who runs the New Republic. Likewise, Ezra Klein, Matt Iglesias, Spencer Ackerman, Paul Rosenberg, Sion, Ian Welsh, and Cecilia Newberry have done a tremendous job of stepping outside the usual suspect sources and taking advantage of a new freedom to explore the subject of Israel from a multiplicity of viewpoints. And I could add, you know, all sorts of blogs beyond that. Gershon Gorenberg, who has been on Blogging Heads before and really wrote, I'm not an authority on the subject, but I thought The Accidental Empire was an absolutely must-read book on the history of the conflict. He blogs at SouthJerusalem.com now. Pat Lang, who blogs at Six Separate Tyrannus, does interesting stuff too. Juan Cole's side blog, the Informed Comment group blog, has great stuff there. MJ Rosenberg at TPM Cafe. So there's really a lot of stuff going on out there. And I could go on as far as why. I think there's more reasons than what Jane enumerates, though I agree with what Jane says. I think there's more reasons why. But it's nice to be able to have these discussions, and not for just the sake of having a nice conversation, of course. It's a very serious, you know, plight that we're looking at. But I think we're going to get better policies because we can have a more freer discussion without getting hysterical smears in response to people expressing their viewpoints.
Yeah, I guess I don't have the numbers to back me up on this, but just from my own very thorough reading of the leftosphere from when I was paid to do just that, I don't notice any particular uptick. Except for the fact there are just more outlets for people to blog at. I mean, I don't remember, Juan Cole or Matthew Iglesias or Spencer Ackerman ever being particularly shy about sharing their honest views on Israel. There are definitely more all the ones you mentioned, more outlets for people to blog their opinion at.
I think it's in part that, I mean, I think for the most part, the people you name, I'd say that's correct. It's more that what they're blogging about is reverberating more and more bloggers are reacting to it and discussing it openly. And they're not just sort of, you know, blogging on the margins of the blogosphere and not becoming part of the larger conversation. I know myself, I publicly said at one point in my early blogging, when I started blogging in 2002, it was right in the middle of a Middle East flashpoint. I blogged about it for several days, and I got to a point after a year where I said, forget it. You know, there's no constructive dialogue to be had here, so what's the point of blogging about it? I'm getting a lot of angry email, and I'm not pushing this conversation forward, so I wash my hands of it for the time being. I end up coming back to it several years later. I know that there are a lot of individual Air America hosts. You know, there's no decree by Air America, of course, not to talk about it. But I think Randy Rhodes at one point said, "Look, I just don't talk about this. I just get, you know, just burns up the phones and a lot of yelling and screaming. And what do you get out of it?" So it's been a difficult subject on the left because there is a range of viewpoint on the left about it. Jimmy Carter got his hat handed to him in many respects when he put out Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid. But I think that's also a development that's worth pointing to here, something that's pushed the dialogue along, even though we got a firestorm of criticism after it. So I think the dynamic on the left is very different now than it was 4 years ago, and hopefully there'll actually be some substantive benefits from that.
You talk about moving the dialogue forward. What do you imagine the substantive policy changes being?
Well, you know, MJ Rosenberg made an interesting observation on TPM Cafe that, you know, on one sense you can say, you know, Obama's stated remarks throughout the campaign and now are not all that different than Bush's. You know, he doesn't want to negotiate with Hamas. Israel's a steadfast ally, special relationship. But there was a tonal difference between what David Axelrod did on Meet the Press this Sunday than what the Bush administration did. Whereas the Bush administration was, you know.
Oh, you mean David Axelrod, the guy who has sworn to us he's not going to be like Karl Rove and not going to affect policy in any way?
Well, I don't know if he's shaping David policy, Axelrod? But he was on Meet the Press as a spokesperson of the administration, of the incoming administration. When you know, the White House did a very standard condemnation of Hamas for their role in the conflict, Axelrod emphasized a special relationship with Israel, but he didn't go out of his way to do the blanket condemnation of Hamas in that appearance. And Rosenberg took that as an example of the incoming Obama administration looking to be more of an honest broker and not just simply paint this as a very black and white good guy bad guy situation, recognizing that there is fault on both sides here, not being afraid of having conservatives attack them for being more relativist and all that. It could just be, you know, symbolism with no substance behind it. You know, the policy is very soon going to be much more important than the rhetoric. But it was an indication that perhaps they feel a bit more comfortable taking a more subtle approach here, and hopefully that'll give them more credibility in the region to actually find some common ground, tamp down conflict, and actually be able to have a working environment for substantive peace negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just point to a Jeffrey Goldberg post over at The Atlantic. He writes, "If someone was sending rockets on my house where my daughters are sleeping at night, I would do everything to stop it, and I would expect Israelis to do the same thing. Those aren't my words, they're Barack Obama's, but I attach myself to this sentiment. Obama said this in July after visiting the southern Israeli town of Sderot. Visits to Sderot will do that for you, make you see things clearly. For what it works, this is how I see what's happening in Gaza." And he goes on, "No country in the world would afford to ignore such attacks, and no country would. An elected government such as this is a basic overriding responsibility to protect its citizens from the organized violence of its enemies." So, you know, I mean, we'll see, you know, what Obama's actual policy, you know, is when he gets in the office to change it. But, I wouldn't expect the news to be that much different 4 years from now or 8 years from now. But we'll see.
I mean, it'd be hard to predict otherwise based on the track record of the region. And I certainly don't think Obama is all of a sudden going to negotiate directly with Hamas when he said so clearly that, he would not. But let's keep in mind, Israel negotiates with Hamas. They've had a ceasefire for 6 months, but based on their negotiations, and they're more than willing to negotiate again. And if the, an Obama administration is looking to lean on Israel more than the Bush administration did to push for some working compromises, when factions of Hamas, as they did when they first came into elective office after elections, put out some feelers and made some olive branches, you might have an Obama administration being more receptive to that and take some steps to give those olive branches some credibility and not have them be swatted down. So I see the opportunity for a very different Middle East in a four-year period, but it would be crazy for anybody to get overly optimistic and assume it's all going to transform right away because these problems have been so intractable for so long.
Well, I will predict that the first 6 months, Obama's going to fly to Jakarta, that being the capital of the Muslim nation he's going to speak to. And we'll see what he says about the situation then. But
I guess there's talk between Jakarta and Cairo.
What's your money on?
Maybe now, maybe not Cairo.
My money was always on Jakarta.
Egypt's a little bit too close to all this. I could see Turkey being a possibility also.
Yeah, but you don't have the homecoming angle.
But some people argue that the homecoming angle somewhat undermines it. It makes it a little less dramatic that he's taking a trip to where he was a kid for a time as opposed to going for a place that's a little bit more seen as the heart of the Arab world.
We'll find out. But in the meantime, just to go back to some nice good old-fashioned blogger sniping. David Bernstein and Glenn Greenwald had a great little back and forth, and I'll just read Bernstein's last entry in it, just because I can. Bernstein writes, "Still waiting for Glenn Greenwald to tell us what would be a proportionate Israeli response to the launching of hundreds of missiles at its civilian population from Hamas-controlled Gaza, as opposed to what he calls Israel's currently massively disproportionate response." In other Greenwald news, just to keep track of who is engaging in what Greenwald calls juvenile and emotional manipulative means of argumentation, Greenwald implicitly acknowledges, as I noted yesterday, that he blogs far more about Israel than I do. But, according to Greenwald, when he blogs constantly about Israel, it's because he's a clear-eyed realist about the implications of Israeli actions of American foreign policy. When I do it less often, it's because I'm an Israeli obsessive. Glad that's cleared up. So anyways, Bernstein was my old con law professor, so anytime he scores points on Glenn's part, it's good for me.
Well, I'm not sure I look at that post as an example of the discourse being all that helpful and constructive.
No, I mean, of all the posts you cited before, I don't think any of the new stuff is that much more constructive than it has been in the past.
Are you accusing your old professor of not being constructive?
I'm making the same accusation of Glenn.
Well, perhaps we should move on to, do you want to go stimulus or everyone's favorite Barack Obama parody song?
Oh, I think, the parody might be the bigger, more fresher issue, so we can do that first if you want.
I gotta say, I think this is a very, the flop of itself is sort of small. But how the various strands of the conservative movement are handling it, I find extremely interesting as far as a part of their regrouping process and deciding how to go from here, how to regain credibility, expand their base, etc. My take from what conservative blogs I was reading was a general support for Chip Saltzman, former Tennessee GOP chair, who sent out a CD as a gift to our RNC members.
Yeah, I don't know where on earth you get that from.
I'm more Politico, happy to be corrected.
And Politico ran that headline, what was it, Obama CD to help Saltzman. And you read through the article, and no one says that.
I mean, I read posts from Rick Moran, Right Wing Nuthouse, Michelle Malkin.
Right, right.
Newsbusters, Real World View. Powerline, all those guys were to some degree supportive of Saltzman sending out this parody song as part of the CD.
No, I don't think you read Michelle's post correctly enough. I think okay. What Michelle said was that everyone's overreacting to this, but that it was still unwise of Chip to do it. And it's the same thing that you saw in the Politico.
I said degree.
Right.
There's a degree of support that expands.
I wouldn't call that support. I mean, it's not like everyone's like, yes, Chip, this was a great idea. Everyone should try to, you know, do stuff like this in their campaigns. It was
are there any conservative bloggers that are saying this is a inherently racist parody and it's disgusting and it should have any part to do with the conservative movement whatsoever? Is anybody saying that?
I don't think anyone's coming out and calling Chip a racist. It's more of
Chip's a racist, but the song is a racist song. The Al Sharpton impersonation is inherently racist, and we don't want anything remotely like that being associated with the conservative movement. Is there anybody making that argument?
No. I mean, I'm sure there is somewhere, but you know, I think the more general accusation is, you know, this is just a dumb move by Chip. Let me read a post by Ala Pundit at Hot Air that I think is more kind of representative of the conservative blogging community here. Tapper, as in Jake Tapper, reminds us of the song's genesis in a lefty L.A. Times op-ed about conventions of authenticity, which lyrics the parody and the one's good humor in laughing it off when you asked about it last year. I don't mind folks poking fun at me, Obama said. Which leaves us with this tediously predictable debate. If the song's not clearly racist, should Chip Salzman be scolded for circling it? Some righties say yes, since we know that the media will do what the media will do with it and how it'll affect voter perceptions of the GOP. Others say no, that they'll be damned before they let the left set the parameters of what's politically correct. Count me in the former group, with Garrity and John Avalon. There are perhaps principles so important that it's worth risking the party's viability to defend them. Strong borders and into bailout mania, but the use of archaic terms like Negro that's disfavored by blacks doesn't strike me as one of them. If you disagree and think the real principle here is resisting ever-expanding Orwellian universe of unacceptable terms, fair enough. But be prepared to divert party resources from other business to try to convince blacks that they shouldn't feel uneasy about words that cause them unease.
I mean, what I find so striking about these, I mean, it's a rationalization for defending the parody itself.
Mm-hmm.
You're separate from Chip Salzman's, you know, political acumen sending it around. And, you know, when you look at, the song is not making fun of Barack. You know, for Barack Obama to say, I don't mind when people make fun of me, that's sort of like a fine political thing for him to say, but to listen to the song, Barack Obama's not the butt of the joke. The butt of the joke is white liberals for having superficial reasons for supporting Barack.
Yeah.
And Al Sharpton for being the sort of buffoonish race hustler.
Yeah.
And
seems to be the position of the New York Times.
I'm sorry?
I said the fact that Al Sharpton is a buffoonish race hustler seems to be the position of the New York Times.
Well, I mean there are substantive criticisms to make about Al Sharpton.
Right.
There are substantive criticisms to make about
white liberals
who have silly reasons for their actions sometimes. But the Al Sharpton impersonation, which is extremely charitable to call it that, is a minstrel show. That's what's racially offensive here. And you play 5 seconds of the song on the radio or TV, and that is evident to anybody listening to it. So to see conservative bloggers, you know, go through all these contortions to justify the song, I think, on its face.
So to recap, you're okay with making fun of Al Sharpton as a race hustler and white liberal guilt, but you just want it to be done well.
Be done in a non-racist way. I mean, satire's fine. Making fun of people's political stances is fine. But to caricature a race of people is one of the tenets of racism.
Well, I guess, you know, some people will say the Al Sharpton voice is characterizing an entire race. Other people will just say it's characterizing Al Sharpton.
Well, everyone always makes excuses for things. You know, Field Negro, African-American blogger, says, I always wonder what the black folks in the RNC camp are thinking. Do they think it's funny? Are they embarrassed? Do they pick up the phone, call their comrades at arms and say, hey, man, you are killing me here? Do they tell the Republican pals they're making it way too easy for certain bloggers of color and black folks to label the party as insensitive? Asura at Tapped says, there's never been a funnier parody, Eric Erickson at Red State says. This guy doesn't even get the joke. Has no idea of the cultural forces that produce the widely used term that he attributes to a columnist whose column he hasn't read. The intended audience is itself too dense and too ignorant to even come close of getting David Ehrenstein's point, the person who actually wrote the original column that the song's based on. Like good little ditto bots, they defend the song as parody. They just can't tell you what it means. The defense of the song amounts to complaints that everyone else is too dumb to get the brilliance of the satire that is beyond their capacity to explain, which forces one to ask the question, if they don't get the joke, what exactly do they think is so damn funny? What perplexes me here is, I think almost everyone at the party realizes, everyone at the conservative movement realizes, that they're not going to, this is the Karl Rove argument, we are not going to sustain as an all-white entity. There are things that we need to do to expand our reach and make our arguments heard by different groups of people. And then to go through these wild machinations to explain what is, obviously racist. I mean, you don't have to listen to The Voice for 5 seconds, and it's a clearly racist, stereotypical minstrel show thing to do.
Yeah, I just think it's just not that funny of a parody. I guess I'm at a disadvantage here. But at the same time, I don't think it's racist. I do think it is, has definitely opportunity to offend people.
You think that is an excellent, spot-on impersonation of Al Sharpton and not at all related to a two-dimensional caricature of what an average urban black person talks like.
I absolutely love Jon Stewart's two-dimensional impersonation of Bush. I laugh at it every time. I think it's hilarious. I tune in most nights just to watch that impersonation. I didn't find the Sharpton one to be particularly funny, but I don't think that you have to have every impersonation be spot on in order to be within the bounds of debate.
I mean, there's bad impersonations, and there are impersonations that are relying on long-standing, disgusting, inaccurate stereotypes. The Daily Show explores race issues, so much that it's going to be very hard to tag The Daily Show as trying to do racist things. Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I don't think anyone would.
Shaman,
I don't think anyone would tag
that
Jon Stewart as being racist for caricaturing George Bush. I think what I'm trying to say is that, humor is always going to be in the eye of the beholder. This was funny to some people, offensive to others, and it's a matter of taste. And for Chip to go ahead and use that without knowing that some people might find this offensive and not find it funny, just signals a tone deafness, which I very heartily agree is a problem within the conservative movement and the Republican Party. And I was actually shaping up to be a Chip fan until the story first broke. For me, just like, Kate and Dawson's membership in an exclusive club down in South Carolina, you go on Red State, you'll still see posts defending Dawson's membership in that club. They'll explain that, if you go to the club, there are actually black people there, you walk by, Kate didn't know. And it's like, you guys just don't get it. It's the very fact that, it was exclusive. Means it's a story for the press, and it's just issue over Caden's Don. And it's the same with Chip in this story. It's just, bad politics. It was questionable taste to begin with, and to go ahead and use it at a sensitive time was just foolish, and he'll pay the price.
Do you think that in the conservative blogosphere, there is an – I mean, because my general sense of things was that, younger conservatives are a little bit more – appreciative of getting past, the Dixiecrat mentality and having a wider tent. But at the same time, that kind of cuts against the sort of love of being politically incorrect.
It's a fine line to walk.
Yeah,
it is. You're right. And so you have to exercise extreme taste and caution when doing it. And Chip didn't, and he's going to pay the price.
Should we leave it there and move on to the economic recovery package?
Stimulus it is.
So, it seems like the conservative blogosphere is gathering their ammo. The timing of this, it seems to me, is Congress gets sworn in on January 6th.
Right.
Obama is inaugurated January 20th.
Right.
There is some hope that Congress can get an economic recovery plan passed and put on his desk on January 20th.
Hope, that's the plan.
The Obama team has started to tamp that down a little bit. They're worried about delaying tactics. They don't want to set the bar too high for themselves. But obviously they want to get it done as soon as possible. And you're starting to see in the conservative blogosphere some attempts of strategizing to, I guess I'm not even quite sure, I know what I think the conservative endgame is on this, but when I ask you, what do you think, are they trying to kill it, are they trying to reform it, what do you think they're trying to do here?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of fait accompli that there's no way you're going to completely kill it. So, I mean, it's great that you think we have an endgame in mind. I don't think we do. Patrick Cuffini at The Next Right had a good post on the stimulus. He writes, first he cites a Brooks article on what David Brooks would like to see, and he says, in 2002, when Mark Warner tried to push through a tax increase referendum to pay for roads in Northern Virginia, he was thwarted by environmentalists and progressives. The outer suburbs, nominally more Republican, voted for the referendum. Alexandria and Arlington voted against it, with precinct-by-precinct returns tracking closely with proximity to metro stations. This means a huge chunk of Obama's natural consistency will be soft on the infrastructure-heavy stimulus, and to that extent, there are still voices within the fiscal sanity. There are still voices of fiscal sanity left in the Democratic Party that may balk at the price tag of as much as $675 to $775 billion over 2 years, which would be the largest, most dramatic dollar-per-dollar expansion of government and the national debt in American history. It would also be good to be on the side of good government for once. Brooks's embrace of central planning aside, he is right that there just isn't $1 trillion of shovel-ready work ready to go, which means a lot of haphazard, fly-by-night crap getting funded. The stories of waste, fraud, and abuse from these projects will be legion. We may not agree ideologically with all who may want the stimulus to be more carefully planned out to fund their pet projects, but from left, center, and right, there will be a unifying argument that the Obama stimulus is a big, hairy mess that just isn't fully baked. Ideally, this unfolds as follows. Republicans begin to tap into Americans' common sense belief in belt tightening as the appropriate response to lean economic times. Families have to make sacrifices. It's time for the government to do the same and not saddle our kids with a trillion more in debt on top of bailout after bailout after bailout. Or taking on more debt than we could afford is what got us into this mess. Now they're saying that talking on more will get us out. Give me a break. We then introduce a $250 billion package of targeted tax cuts and small business incentives we cite as a rationale for the figure Obama's own economist, Christina Romer, who has found a times three multiplier effect from tax reduction, while other mainstream economists who say the multiplier from spending increase is only one. We argue that this package would have the same impact as the inefficient and wasteful Obama stimulus. If they can be brazen and maximalist, so can we. Plus, it would be nice to hold fast to a position that doesn't concede spending hikes. If Obama looks like he's throwing money at the wall and undermining his own promise to build a green economy to boot, there is ample opportunity to reclaim the mantle of sane governance and fiscal responsibility, but only if you're serious about seizing it and not just another piece of the bailout action.
You know, there's part of that which I find wildly wishful thinking. Where he says, Democrats will hopefully delay the package as they figure out how to divvy up the spoils, which currently favor 91% male unionized construction workers over women and environmentalists. It's such a transparently cynical attempt to try to divide the Democratic coalition, which is not even going to happen because this package is going to be so large that you're not going to be stuck with having to do these sorts of trade-offs.
I agree. When the numbers keep going up and up, there's a lot less, There's a lot more pie to share, so I don't think you're going to have the environmentalists and the other unions fighting over it because there's enough pork or go around to keep everyone happy.
And I was hard to know that Ruffini is very concerned about the concentration of males in the skilled trades. I'm sure he's done scores of blogging about opening up skilled labor to more women. I'm sure there's a lot of folks in the feminist community that would love to have Patrick Ruffini's help on that, now that he's shown his sensitivity to the subject. But the bigger strategy, seems to me, stories of waste, fraud, and abuse from these projects will be legion. That seems to be the more practical hope from the right. Nate Silver at 538, in talking about his view of what's going on in Republican congresspeople's heads. Somewhere along the way, they're going to wind up funding a Woodstock Museum or a Bridge to Nowhere. Somewhere along the way, an enterprising contractor is going to embezzle a bunch of stimulus money or cook up some kind of pay-to-play scheme. Maybe if you're really lucky, this will happen in your district. Better keep the whole thing at arm's length and make sure the Democrats will get the blame for that. I think it's not unreasonable to predict that in something this large, something will go wrong somewhere. We're human beings.
Billy, still there?
We're human beings. We're imperfect people, and an $800 billion plus package will have some bad apple somewhere.
You're out near Boston, aren't you?
I am near Boston. I'm 2 hours from Boston, and a lot of people aren't happy with the Big Dig.
Exactly.
I'm for the Big Dig. The Big Dig would, if something suddenly had the reputation of a Big Dig.
Exactly. The Big Dig times 1,000.
If we had a Big Dig times 1,000, then sure. Well, I'll caveat that by, you know, I think as a general rule, people will tolerate a fair amount of corruption if things are going well for them personally. If the economy is going gangbusters by 2010, corruption arguments are going to get you very far.
Let's go ahead and bet that it's not, and then there's 1,000 Big Digs on top of that.
Then that's your golden opportunity to say, you know, active government is inherent disaster, and the progressive opportunity window will have been missed probably for a generation. That's your best bet. And where I think there is some bit of an endgame on the conservative side is, I think the general consensus is that speed is necessary right now. There is an urgency to getting part of this package in the pipeline, the shovel-ready projects up and running to mitigate the current recession as best as possible. There's long-term things that need to be done that are going to encompass a good chunk of a package of this size. We want as much short-term stuff done as soon as possible. If you can delay and get this thing passed, you know, by March instead of January, you make it all that much harder for people to feel any short-term benefits to mitigate the pain of 2009, which is 2009 pain is inevitable at this point. If you can do that, and then you can cherry-pick out a couple of bad examples out of an extremely large package, then maybe you have some political juice to work with. And that's why I wrote a blog post myself at ourfuture.org and Huffington Post trying to light a fire under the left, because I don't think the liberal blogosphere, you know, there's some blogging on, of course, but it's not nearly the level of intensity and coordination as it was with, say, the flap over Rick Warren's invocation.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, McConnell and Boehner had a press conference, and Boehner just released a statement. But Boehner's statement called for Obama and the Democratic leadership to promise to post a full copy of the stimulus bill on the internet and have it readable and accessible for a full week before there are any votes. That seems to be the kind of open and transparency thing that I know Heritage would agree with. We could get the Sunlight Foundation on board, mm-hmm. and hopefully even you guys over at CAF and Open Left, who are interested in transparency, to get on board with that type of request.
Well, I think people would be open to that. You know, D-Day, he blogged recently, "I have no problem with the 72-hour rule between drafting a bill and voting on it. But I am touched by the newfound concern of congressional Republicans about fraud and waste. They took an 8-year break from caring about this and allowed giant bricks of money to be given away in Iraq, and a government concerned far more with profit-taking than fulfilling its regulatory mission. But they can be forgiven for this temporary lack of attention to the destination of taxpayer money. After all, it is a new year coming up and changes in the air." I don't have a problem with it myself. I do think, and we've seen some of this already, an attempt to take a line item out of, say, I've blogged about this before. U.S. Conference of Mayors had their wish list. Now, this is what they said they thought was shovel ready. These are our radio projects.
Which we talked about before.
We did. National Taxpayers Union had a hissy fit about all of zoos and museums and bike paths and a water park ride in Miami.
Hey, man, we threw a hissy fit too.
I didn't mean to. It's a slight Heritage Foundation there. But when CNN, you know, carried NTU's water on this and did a very hysterical report about it, there are $300 million of pork in this. Well, it's a $73 billion package. So that's one half of 1% of what you're complaining about. So I don't mind putting it up there and letting people look at it, but I would also urge people to look at it in context and actually realize that the vast majority of you can pluck out things and make them look silly without actually exploring the merits of the project. And two, the vast majority of this is almost surely going to be things of not just merit, but of necessity, if we're actually going to strengthen our energy system, strengthen our roads and bridges, strengthen our rail, I got to say one thing here. Michelle Malkin's post on High Speed Rail that you sent to me.
Oh, yes. Well, I want to talk about it, but you go first.
Oh, this is so illuminating to how conservatives are approaching this debate.
Well, I do try to illuminate you, Bill.
So, Michelle Malkin, so she's talking about the plan. California's moving ahead on high-speed rail, which would connect L.A. to San Francisco. So Michelle writes...
Depends what you mean by moving ahead, because California's broke.
Well, they passed the ballot initiative to actually raise the money to move on the project. And I should say, 10 years ago, I actually did some work for the California High-Speed Rail Authority, and there was an attempt to get that ballot measure done 10 years ago, and California flinched on doing it. And, you know, if we had done it back then, they would actually be in place by now, and it would be a whole world of difference. Michelle writes, where to begin? It currently costs $49 one way to fly Southwest from Oakland to Los Angeles. That flight takes about an hour and 15 minutes. How much do you think it will cost to ride the high-speed rail line from O-Town to L.A.? For comparison's sake, government-funded Amtrak trips from Washington to New York's Penn Station cost about $133 one way on the Joe Biden-endorsed Acela, if they're running. That trip takes about 2 hours and 45 minutes. So here's Michelle. I think she's making this perfect, damning argument about how silly and crazy high-speed rail is. Never mind that high-speed rail works fantastically well in several European countries and Japan. So here's what she leaves out of that example. If you have high-speed rail from L.A. to San Francisco, number one, L.A. to San Francisco is the heaviest, at least it was 10 years ago, maybe things have changed now, but 10 years ago, it was the heaviest traveled air corridor in the world. And so constantly racked with delays, and that just gums up your ability to travel up and down the state, but since these are international airports, it gums up travel all over the world. So you need to have some other transportation alternative there.
Or you can just build more runways.
What's that?
Or you can just build more runways.
Have you ever seen the San Francisco airport? It's not going to be that, wouldn't be that simple to do.
There are more airports in the Bay Area than there's San Jose, there's Oakland. You can even go out to Stockton or Fresno.
I'm aware of the Bay Area. You're aware of the Bay Area. I'm aware of the Bay Area. I think airport expansion there would be a little complicated. Not to mention there's a lot of global warming issues involving air travel. If you can have non-fossil fuel-based transport systems, that's a benefit in and of itself. And I know you believe in global warming because you told me. So, secondly, she says $49 to L.A. to Oakland, hour 15 minutes. What she leaves out of that is travel time to the airport and the security check you need to go through the airport, which adds a new... You have to go to the airport 2 hours early.
No, an hour early.
What's that?
Oh, an hour early.
A lot of places you still think you have to go 2 hours nowadays because of all the security check through. If you're doing high-speed rail, you're going downtown to downtown. You're stepping off the train and you're there. There's no travel time to get to the airport or from the airport. So it's a totally different calculation, and not to mention there's costs getting to and from the airport. So she's inherently making an extremely disingenuous, non-apples-to-apples comparison, which only says to me, she's not seriously, and she is a person, but I think conservatives in general, are not seriously engaging in these debates. They're not actually interested in finding the right solution to our infrastructure problems. They're just looking to, you know, throw crap against the wall and hope something sticks and hope that we actually don't have a full spotlight on all the details of these issues to actually make informed decisions.
Well, I'm all for being there more, you know, full hashing of details on the issues. And, you know, you're right that there would be two different things, but, you know, they are comparable because there are, you know, two different modes of transport to getting down there. I mean, there's also existing freight rail to get down there because a lot of stuff gets there. And a lot of the traffic is freight also, but... people can also fly the plane, and it's not the exact same, but it is, you know, somewhat comparable. And so there are cost benefit analysis to make. You left out the end of her post, where she writes, the bureaucrats say it'll cost $30 billion plus $12 billion for every extension, which means you should triple the asking price. There's no need to guess whether this thing will be a money pit. Just look at the Los Angeles, metro black hole.
Well, the logic, and I haven't followed it as closely lately, but 10 years ago the logic was, and this is why, you know, we have airports, by the way, private companies generally don't have the financial incentive to invest in the initial infrastructure. You know, airlines don't build airports. Governments build airports. In this case, the government was going to have to build the rail system because a private company would not put the upfront capital into doing that because it's expensive and there's a lot of financial risk involved. So you're subsidizing the initial infrastructure. At the time, they were talking about having a private company actually run the rail system once it was up and running. I don't know if that's still what they're planning to do. But it's not necessarily going to be all that upfront cost is going to be funneled into the price of a ticket, making a ticket completely economically unreasonable for a train rider. Obviously, if it's not going to be an affordable ticket, no one's going to use it. People have thought about these challenges. It's not like Michelle all of a sudden came up with a criticism that no one ever thought about before. There's a reason why high-speed rail works in France and in Germany and in Japan. They address these issues and everything works very well. So it's hard to make the argument that this is somehow an impossible thing to do.
Yeah, well, it's definitely not an impossible thing to do. The question is how much over the cost and what are the other alternatives and are they more cost-effective?
I mean, that's a perfectly appropriate debate to have.
And I think that's the one she's having, although in blog post form and
having,
while trying
she's
to score
having
parts
an honest
of
discussion
points.
About that. She's making a lot of disingenuous arguments to avoid having an actual cost-benefit debate on the merits.
I don't think it's disingenuous. She's saying this thing's going to be a money pit and it's not worth it. She's saying all the projected estimates you're getting from the California government about how much these things are thing is going to cost is you know, complete fantasy guesswork, and it's going to be a massive big dig disaster.
You don't think the California High Speed Rail Authority knows what their estimated ticket price is going to be at the end of this? Of course they do. Did she bother to find out?
See, this is,
she didn't.
Well, of course they have an idea of what their estimated ticket price is going to be. But see, that's, again, the fundamental difference between Republicans and conservatives, that Democrats and liberals believe planned experts can get into a room and have all the necessary information inputs to tell you what that ticket price is going to be 10 years, 15 years down the line when this project gets finished. And conservatives say, no, there's no way that the estimate is anywhere near the truth.
Well, if Michelle can't even do a honest apples-to-apples comparison about the time it's going to take to go from one city to another, I don't trust her ability to look at the data that a government agency would potentially give her. I mean, obviously, it's going to be public information. I mean, they've been studying this for 10 years in California, and I was there when they were doing all these public hearings, addressing all these issues back then. They're not going to just pull a number out of the air. There's going to be a reason for the numbers they come up with.
Oh, they're going to pull numbers out of the
say,
air.
Well,
they're going to pull the numbers out of the air that support the policy
that's
they were created.
That's a completely knee-jerk assumption on your part.
The government entity you're talking about was created for the specific purpose of making this policy come to life. Why on God's green earth would it produce numbers that went against its very reason for existing?
Well, keep in mind, California High Speed Rail Authority, as I said, you know, they flinched from doing this 10 years ago. You know, they didn't just go balls to the wall, who cares what the economic damage is going to be, we're just going to do this, you know, hell or high water. They made it, they pulled themselves back. Actually, they were wrong in doing it, but that's what they did. I think it's a fair point that obviously they obviously have an interest in having this work, that you wouldn't set up the agency unless you wanted to accomplish it. But you can look at what they give to you and assess the quality of their work and then make a judgment, not just assume by definition anything they put out is inherently going to be flawed. I didn't see you saying that everything the Bush administration put out is inherently – everything the Bush administration said about Iraq is inherently flawed because they really want to go into Iraq. No one made that argument back then. So look at the quality of what they put out and make the judgment on that.
Fair enough. Do you want to move on to unions?
Sure.
You had an Ezra Klein post you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, well, there's definitely been a lot – after the auto rescue plan after the beating in public opinion, I think, that the UAW took throughout this whole spectacle, there's been, and at the same time, a sense that Obama is going to be a more ally of unionization than George Bush was. So these sort of these competing pressures. So there's been a lot more talk in the media about where the union movement goes from here. And keying off a New York Times story and that Ezra Klein said, I'll only add that the last great leap forward for unions was during World War II, and the last great expansion of the American middle class followed in its aftermath. In contrast, the most recent expansions, which have largely occurred in the absence of unions, have benefited America's rich. Unions do not change economic growth, or at least as little convincing evidence that they do. The country's the world's highest growth rate, the Nordic economy, it's also some of the world's highest rates of unionization. Denmark, Sweden, and Finland all approach 80%. Rather, unions change the distribution of economic growth. They direct more of it to the middle class and less of it to the executive class. The past few years have been an economy driven by the executive class. The question is whether that's what we want the next expansion to look like also. So I think you're going to see those. I mean, you know full well that the conservative blogosphere and conservative movement is extremely focused on trying to stop the Employee Free Choice Act from getting passed. I find it fascinating how they're prioritizing the issue. But these questions about whether unions are inherently good or inherently bad are gonna kick up at some point over the next few years. And while you know UAW has been taking on the chin for, I think, getting unfair blame for what's happened with the U.S. auto industry, there's an argument that Ezra Klein can easily make, saying you know the union membership, union strength has gone down over the last 30 years. Has our economy gotten better at the same time? Most people would say no.
Well, now's a particular good data point to make that argument. But, you know, Mickey Kaus, big union lover that he is, responded to Klein's post. He block quoted the section you just read about benefiting the rich, and he writes, "The biggest recent expansion was during the 90s. A, benefited Americans at all levels, but especially average workers, and B, occurred largely while union power was ebbing. The Clintonite formula worked. Maybe it can't be achieved again. Maybe it's flawed because, sorry, the rich got richer, too, under the Clinton years. Maybe a return to Carter-era union power will be better still. But those are arguments Dems like Drum and Klein won't even deign to make as long as they keep reassuring each other that they not only have the best ideas around, but the only ideas around." Klein also argues that the countries with the world's highest growth rates, the Nordic economies, also have some of the world's highest rates of unionization. Denmark, Sweden, and Finland, all approaching 80%. There's an argument that in countries with 70 to 80, 90% unionization, unions have to be more responsible. Union leaders know that any inflationary wage increases are going to be paid for by their own members, and they know that any declines in productivity will hurt their own members. Not only do they have an incentive to be reasonable, but they have the power to keep their own membership, say those unions that could get bigger than average increases by striking, in check. But we aren't going to get 80% unionization. We're going to get 20 to 25% unionization, or maybe 30, with unions that are powerful enough to cut good deals for themselves, but not so large that they have to take everyone's interest into account. So that's Kaus's more succinct example, but Richard Posner, who blogs at the Becker Posner blog, Posner's a Sixth Circuit judge in the Court of Appeals, writes, more specifically about unions, but a more theoretical example. "The goal of unions is to redistribute wealth from the owners and managers of firms and from workers willing to work for very low wages to the unionized workers and the union's officers. Unions do this by organizing or threatening strikes that impose costs on employers. For employers are rationally willing to avoid these costs at a cost of higher wages and benefits and restrictive work rules. Because the added cost to the employer of a unionized workforce is a marginal cost, unionization results in reduced output by the unionized firm and, in consequence, benefits non-unionized competitors. Unless those competitors are too few or too small to be able to expand output at a cost no higher than the cost of the unionized firms, unionization will gradually drive out the unionized firms out of business. Unions, in other words, are like worker cartels. Workers threaten to withhold their labor unless paid more than a competitive wage, including benefits and work rules. But unless their union is able to organize all the major competitors in the market, the cartel will be eroded by the entry of non-unionized firms, which by virtue of not being unionized will have lower labor costs. The parallels to producer cartels exact are producers. We are seeing this process of erosion of labor monopolies at work in the automobile industry. The market share of Detroit automakers has shrunk steadily relative to that of the foreign transplants, and with the number of unionized auto workers, they are fewer by a third or more than they were in the 1970s. If the Detroit automakers will be forced to liquidate unless they can bring their labor costs down to the level of foreign transplants, the UAW will be out of business either because the Detroit automakers liquidate or because as a result of union concessions, the workers will no longer be getting anything in exchange for the dues they pay the union. I don't think there's much to be said on behalf of unions, at least under current economic conditions. The redistribution of wealth they bring is not only fragile, for the reasons just suggested, but also capricious, as it is an accident whether conditions in a particular industry are favorable to unionization or not." So that's a more theoretical reason of why unions are bad for the economy, which, as a long economics guy myself, I agree with wholeheartedly.
Why do you think conservatives care so much about breaking the union movement in this country?
Because we're for economic growth, and we think that unions are inherently bad for economic growth.
Now, you just quoted Mickey Kaus.
Yes.
Who made an argument that, and I must say I'm in full agreement with everything Mickey Kaus says, of course, that if you had extreme unionization, nearly the entire workforce unionized, that they approach the economy in a better way, and it's very healthy for the economy. So why wouldn't concern, if economic growth was the concern, why not then do everything you could to unionize all sectors of the economy? And so unions would then think more macroeconomically.
Yeah, well, I guess conservatives don't think workers and unions run companies well, or that they wouldn't. We don't think they run the economy well. We think that
I mean, it's one thing to believe that theoretically, but you know, we can argue that there have been times in America's economy when things have been relatively good, when there was a lot of unionization, and times when it was pretty good when there was a lot of unionization, like in the 90s. I would argue.
I think the only time that it was good with unionization was a very special time in which, you know, the America was the only manufacturing power in the world, since the rest of the world had just basically been reduced to rubble in a world war.
I don't see why that negates the point.
Because it's the only time, because when America had that advantage of being the only, you know, manufacturing power in the world, unions like Detroit were able to get fat off the land. They didn't really have anybody to compete with, so they were able to strike, you know, huge deals with Detroit
automakers
and be rich.
But your argument is that the unions are so evil. They're so detrimental
to
the economy.
They're not evil. They're no more evil than monopolies or any type of other, you know, cartel-like behavior.
Except unions can never fully monopolize a situation because there's always going to be management as well. It's a question of achieving some balance. I still understand.
But the UAW does have a monopoly on labor in the Detroit in Detroit auto market.
They don't have a monopoly on the auto market.
No, not on the market, but on labor. Labor is an input to you know, just like steel is an input. There's no monopoly in steel that Detroit has to put up with. They can buy their steel from anyway. But there is a monopoly they have to put up with labor, and that hurts them competitively.
I'm more concerned.
They can buy their rubber from wherever they want. They can get their capital from different banks. There's no front that Detroit has to deal with a monopoly on except in the market for labor.
I'm not interested in getting into a back and forth on this per se, because we can spend all day. It's one thing to hold the opinion.
Right.
It's one thing to have, you know, the arguments that you have. But when, you know, the Chamber of Commerce says it's going to be Armageddon if a bill is passed that simply says the decision whether a workforce unionizes via a card check or a ballot election is in the hands of workers and not in the hands of management. That constitutes an Armageddon moment. That is how deeply and upset and angry, and obviously it seems the conservative blogosphere is very much of the same mindset. So it's one thing to say, you know, I don't think unions are a good idea, and I would argue against them. It's another thing to say, I'm going to just clear the decks and put all of my chips focusing on this, because I think they're so inherently awful. I don't understand the mentality behind the prioritization of the issue.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that, you know, card check's not a top priority. It is, but, you know, I mean, you know, we're against it. You know, other people are going to – I don't think it's anyone – well, maybe the Chamber or and NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers. But, you know, right now stimulus is our priority. Cap and trade's a big priority. Fighting socialized medicine's a big priority. There are lots of other priorities.
Stimulus. Well, take stimulus, for example. Here,
stimulus is also a priority for us fighting.
I mean, right. I mean, stimulus is first. Everyone knows that stimulus is first. That's the January 20th issue. I don't think anyone expects Employee Free Choice Act to come up that early. But you already hear from the conservatives, this is going to pass. What do we do, you know, in lieu of that? There isn't this fire and brimstone. We are going to kill this stimulus package. It is going to destroy the economy. It is big government at its worst.
I think we'd say that.
And
I think
we could save the republic by defeating this now. There's none of that.
None of the stimulus, but there is that for both cap and trade and health care.
Well, you actually mentioned cap and trade because the ones you brought to my attention I thought were fascinating posts at the corner. This increasing, and forgive me if I'm digressing off of unions.
No, we can switch gears to the climate tax issue.
Al Gore, 2 years ago, made this proposal when he testified to Congress that we should impose a tax on carbon to have a disincentive to pollute the atmosphere with carbon emissions and make it revenue neutral by correspondingly reducing the payroll tax. And when he said it at the time, he said, like, I know this is not in the mainstream political thought right now. I know it's not something you can politically accomplish right away, but I'm putting this on the table for you to chew on and think about it, clearly in the hopes that he's going to take his stature and move the debate in his direction. And now you had on Sunday an op-ed from Arthur Laffer of the Laffer Curve and conservative congressperson Bob Inglis making the exact same proposal. And bloggers at the corner embracing it. I just found that quite stunning.
I found it less stunning. You've seen kind of more movements in that direction. First let's say, you know, kind of what it was. The both Laffer and Inglis were for a carbon tax, but I think Charles Krautheimer wants a higher gas tax instead, and I think that was Goldberg and Pernue also were kind of more in the gas tax as opposed to the carbon tax mode. And Jonathan Adler also had right in the corner for it. And I think when you put it in terms of a payroll tax, it does have some added benefits to try to get conservatives on board. But ultimately, I think specifically Adler is just overlooking too many other things to ever make the deal worthwhile for conservatives. Adler writes, conservatives, even those vehemently opposed to greenhouse gas control, should like the deal because it is substantially better than the status quo. As a consequence of Massachusetts versus EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency would be required to regulate greenhouse gases. He goes on, advocates of cap-and-trade system should also support this proposal. Some like to think that the Obama administration can enact a cap-and-trade system under the Clean Air Act through administrative fiat. This is sheer fantasy. The Clean Air Act is not that flexible. And any idea to the contrary should have been dashed when the U.S. Court of Appeals invalidated the Bush administration's effort to create a regional cap-and-trade regime for other pollutants. The most prominent cap-and-trade program, that for acid rain precursors, was enacted by Congress. Legislative change will also be required for an equivalent of the GHG control regime. And so my response to Adler would be, you know, Adler thinks you can get this carbon tax and that will all automatically get rid of a legislative carbon, a legislative cap and trade scheme, or also possibly all the stuff the EPA is planning to put out on carbon regulations. And I just don't think the left would ever go for that. They have too much invested in the cap and trade plan itself, as well as letting the EPA go hog wild on regulating carbon through the Clean Air Act.
Well, there's a fair amount of debate about, you know, the best approach on global warming, and, you know, the argument for cap and trade that involves an auctioning of all the permits, the pollution permits. The basically the cap and trade is you have a cap on the number of how much carbon you can pollute in the air in a given year that gradually declines over time. You issue permits that are equivalent to the limit. Under the auction variation of that plan, you sell those permits, so polluters have to pay for the right to pollute, whereas now they get to pollute the sky for free. And those that do a better job cutting down their pollution will have extra permits that they can then sell and trade them with others who are having a harder time with it. So it allows for a certain flexibility in the system. Proponents who there are carbon tax folks who don't like that because they think it allows corporations to game the system. Those who support it with the auction will say this is equivalent to a carbon tax because it accomplishes the same function. You are making polluters pay to pollute public sky.
But you're still talking cap and trade, and let me tell you briefly.
Well, my only argument to you is that I don't think. You seem to have this notion. I mean, there's this notion on the right that regardless of what you believe global warming is happening or not, that the left's objective in all of this is they don't really care about global warming. They just want an excuse to have more government control over the economy,
right,
and that's
right.
what cap and trade's going
right.
to do. But I think there is an argument that what's good about the carbon tax, putting a price on carbon, doesn't achieve the certainty of having an actual amount capped with the permits. But there's some that argue that
cap and trade.
There's some environmentalists that argue that the carbon tax will be sufficient out of itself that price point will get the job done. So I wouldn't be so dismissive that the left will totally. I mean, this is Gore's argument, mind you. It's Gore who came up with this whole thing to have a carbon tax commensurate with the reduction of the payroll tax. So you have a chance of actually getting the left to come on board with this proposal, because you may not believe it, but there are a lot of liberals who actually care about global warming and don't want it to happen. And if there's an argument to be made that this will solve that problem, liberals will gladly embrace it.
Well, let me just read a post by Ian Murray, and then I'll have some closing thoughts because we're over an hour here. Ian Murray writes to The Corner, "Ramesh, I can't speak to the national security costs of oil except to say that I suspect they generally may be overestimated. But when it comes to climate change, the best research suggests that the tax should be at most about 22 cents per gallon, and probably lower than that. Anything more would be punitive and inefficient. It should also replace all federal fuel economy standards. I might be willing to put up with that exchange, and Detroit would find itself in significant relief, but the enviros just wouldn't stand for it, which shows you exactly how much respect they have for real economic analysis." And I guess my point would be, I think you could get a certain amount of conservatives signed on to a narrow gas tax in exchange for a revenue payroll tax. However, you're not going to see them sign on for a larger carbon tax for the same reason you're never see conservatives sign on for massive cap and trade tax. It's because any type of carbon tax or cap and trade will necessarily involve a huge new amount of government regulation and monitoring of every sector of the economy.
You got to monitor.
Right.
I mean, how do you know how much carbon you're taxing if you're not monitoring?
Exactly. Exactly. And that is what the conservatives will always be against.
Promoting it? What are those who are promoting it right now, Laffer, Inglis, how do they think it's going to work?
I think there are some I don't know if they thought through how it's going to work. What I'm saying is that you could see something attaching just to a gas tax, because that's a tax that it's already implemented. We already can monitor how much people buy in gas and tax it right there. So you're not going to have all the slippage and corruption and losses that you're going to have in any type of cap and trade set. You're not going to have a new massive government bureaucracy needed to monitor every sector of the economy with a gas tax.
Well, remember, if the issue is global warming, and global warming is about carbon emissions, I mean, it's not just taxing things for taxing things' sake. There's arguments to be made for a gas tax, but that's a piece of the global warming puzzle. You know, carbon is the nut of it. So I'll be for a gas tax increase, but it's not necessarily solving the global warming problem.
I think you're touching why, which is why I don't think this is ever going to get done, is because there's just too narrow a common ground here for what the right would be giving up, which is or raising the gas tax, which is what the left have to be up, which would mean all the rest of their carbon cutting agenda. Is that you're just not going to have a common ground on conservatives. Allowing for the massive regulatory scheme it would take to institute an all-out carbon tax, as opposed to a very narrow and doable gasoline tax.
Well, then, if that's the case, because Obama's for cap and trade with auction, as it's what he said, and I think there's a fair amount of momentum towards that. So if there isn't going to be a grand bargain between Al Gore and Arthur Laffer, then yes, we're probably talking about a cap and trade system. I would bet, within the next 2 years, but we will see. We've spent a lot of time, but one of these days, I do want to talk about. I'm constantly fascinated by the caricatures the right has of the left.
Okay.
And submitted as environmentalists won't do X, as if. It's that monolithic group, and it has these sort of
I think you just admitted that you wouldn't give up the whole idea of cap and trade and the Clean Air Act being able to monitor and regulate all greenhouse gases in exchange for just a narrow gas tax, right?
Well, it's understanding what the principles are. There's a principle that environmentalists share, that climate change is a imminent and urgent problem, and so the solutions have to solve that problem. So, I mean, there are a lot of environmentalists who are for a gas tax, but it's not a holistic solution to that problem. So that's the underlying basis. Whereas I think a lot of conservatives look at environmentalists as silly people that don't understand the economy and just like to do symbolic things for the sake of doing them, or the whole environmentalist thing is a total ruse. It's all about control and regulations, rules for no end.
Well, you know, Lieberman-Warner is entirely symbolic. Even if it passed and worked 100%,
but calling it symbolic, I think, is very inaccurate.
It still would not reduce global temperatures in any meaningful way. It wouldn't prevent any of the harms that all the environmentalists.
There are environmentalists that believe that Lieberman Warner was insufficient to the goal, that the targets were not strong
exactly.
enough.
And so in that sense, there was
a strong environmental
symbolic.
Push forward. It's one of the reasons why it barely got out of the box.
I have a sinking feeling we're going to be having this fight again sometime.
I'm sure of the policy fight, okay. But I hope there are discussions, Con. I try not to paint too broad a brush of the right. I hope it's
except,
in having
except
discussions.
Except for calling us all racist, right?
Did I say that? I don't think I did. I find it bizarre when it's defending a racist song. It's not the same as calling you all racist. I hope that I serve some benefit of not having the left caricatured completely as well.
And I'm glad I was able to illuminate you twice this week.
Good to talk to you as always.
See you in the new year.